This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 21st of July, these are our main stories. Donald Trump has addressed his first campaign rally since he narrowly escaped an assassination attempt a week ago. Israel has carried out a series of airstrikes on the port city of Hodeidah in Yemen, which is controlled by the Iranian-backed Houthi movement. The government in the Democratic Republic of Congo has warned of a surging outbreak of Mpox in the country. Also in this podcast...
This is a great way for us to welcome, you know, the people from all over the world and to showcase what the best friends has to offer.
How France is planning to turn the Paris Olympics into a gourmet experience. As we record this podcast, Donald Trump has been holding his first campaign rally since surviving an assassination attempt a week ago. His defiant response after being wounded in the ear has galvanized his supporters and boosted his campaign. In stark contrast to Joe Biden, who's defying growing Democrat calls to stand aside and is still isolating after contracting COVID-19. Like Mr. Trump's last rally, which was in Pennsylvania, this one is also in a key swing state, Michigan. His vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance, took to the stage before Donald Trump to speak about his working class background. He promised to change politics to appeal to lower income voters.
A big belief that I've had for a very long time is that politics, I hate to say it, on both sides, both parties were broken in very profound ways. Both parties, if you remember, signed up for shipping millions of good manufacturing jobs off to Mexico and China until President Trump came along and said, we got to make more of our own stuff, we got to make it with our own workers' hands, and we're going to do it for our own people right here in the United States of America, right here in Michigan.
Then came Mr. Trump himself, who launched a scathing attack on his political rivals.
As we gather this evening and take a look, still... the Democratic nominee, we're going to find out shortly, maybe, I don't know. Let's do a poll. You know, I love doing polls. Who would you most like to run against? We'll start with Kamala Harris, and then we'll go to Crooked Joe Biden, and then we could possibly discuss a few others. So who would you like to most run against if you're us, if we want to win? Ready? Kamala Harris, Crooked Joe Biden. All right. I don't think we have to go too much further.
I spoke to our US correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, in the very noisy venue as Mr. Trump was speaking.
If you're expecting a lot of talk of unity, which is what he promised a few days ago, you're going to be disappointed because there was none of that. This is the original Donald Trump. This is full-fat, unleaded Donald Trump. This is him in full campaign mode, attacking migrants, attacking Democrats, attacking the media, attacking Joe Biden personally as well, even a few moments ago suggesting Joe Biden had a pretty low IQ compared to his. He's been talking about immigration a lot, as you would expect. He's been talking about manufacturing, talking about crime, and particularly because we're in Michigan here, which is a crucial swing state, talking about rejecting things like electric vehicles, bringing jobs back. So it's pretty much what you would normally expect from a campaign, but he is energised. And after what happened last week, he even said he'd taken a bullet for democracy.
And you can see, that his supporters are really backing him. They're cheering him. Tell us about the venue they're in, because obviously security concerns will be high here.
They're in a very buoyant mood. I mean, these are committed supporters. They are delighted that their candidate survived last week by the grace of God, in his words. They queued up for hours before this rally. Some of them camped overnight. Many of them have been left outside in this sort of hockey venue, which holds 12,000 people. It's pretty full. And they have cheered every sentence, quite honestly. This doesn't feel so much like an election rally as a victory rally.
Gary O'Donoghue. Israeli airstrikes have targeted Houthi rebels in Yemen a day after the Iranian-backed fighters claimed they'd managed to fire a drone into Israel's economic hub, Tel Aviv, killing one Israeli and injuring several others. In response, Israel hit oil storage facilities and a power plant in the port of Hodeidah. Images show huge fires with a massive black cloud drifting above. The Houthi-run authorities say at least 80 people have been wounded, most of them with severe burns. In a video message, the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, said his country had sent a clear message to its enemies.
The fire that is now burning in Hodeidah can be seen all over the Middle East. And this matter has clear implications. The Houthis attacked us more than 200 times. The first time they hit an Israeli citizen, we struck them, and we will do so wherever necessary. The blood of Israeli citizens has a price. It's not forsaken. This is known today in Lebanon, Gaza, Yemen, and other places. If they dare attack us, the result will be the same.
For their part, the Houthis say they've been firing at Israel since soon after the start of the war in Gaza in solidarity with Palestinians. They've also been attacking Western ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, upending global trade. The US and Britain have carried out retaliatory strikes. But as our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, told us, this is the first time that Israel has responded directly to the many Houthi attacks aimed at its territory.
They're making the point that after many, many months of what they call Israeli restraint, in the face of what they say are over 200 Houthi projectiles that have been fired towards Israeli territory, the Israelis have felt compelled to respond. I think there was absolutely no doubt following the attack early yesterday morning that landed right in the middle of Tel Aviv and killed one civilian that some kind of Israeli action would be forthcoming and quickly.
And what was hit, as far as we're able to establish? What do we think the targets were?
Well, there are videos showing huge fires raging along the seashore in the port city of Hodeidah. And we've geolocated those fires. It looks like they are oil storage facilities close to the sea. And in fact, that chimes with what the Israelis are saying just now, which is that this was an attack on the port, on targets that Israel says were used for military purposes. That the port, they say, is one of the main supply routes for the transfer of Iranian weapons to Yemen, and that the targets that were hit were, in the Israeli words, dual-use infrastructure, including energy infrastructure.
And is this a one-off retaliation by the Israelis, do you think, or could this possibly be the start of another escalation?
Well, both are possible. I think the Israeli argument at the moment, and we've heard this from the Defense Minister Gallant, is that Israel reserves the right to mount further operations of this kind if attacks continue to be made against Israel. I think clearly the difference this time was that in those scores of previous attacks, very little damage was done and no civilians were killed. That was the first time an Israeli civilian was killed. And the Israelis are saying, if you do that again, you can be absolutely sure we will hit back.
Paul Adams. Well, at the same time as it hit targets in Yemen, Israel is reported to have carried out strikes in southern Lebanon, targeting a depot storing ammunition belonging to Hezbollah, also backed by Iran. Several civilians are said to have been wounded. The government in the Democratic Republic of Congo says an outbreak of mpox is accelerating. There have now been more than 11,000 suspected cases, including 450 deaths. South Africa has also reported 3 deaths. The World Health Organization has warned the disease is a threat to global health. More details from Will Ross.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's health ministry says it's putting in place additional measures to try to stop the mpox cases spreading even faster. As has happened during outbreaks of other diseases that are spread through close contact, the authorities are trying to trace people who have met anyone known to be infected. That's a difficult job in Congo, a vast country with poor infrastructure. There are fears that the current strain of the mpox virus is being transmitted more easily and is more deadly than previous ones. There's also a risk of asymptomatic spread between people who do not have symptoms and have no idea they're carrying the virus.
Will Ross. Let's turn now to Bangladesh, where at least 10 more people have been killed in clashes in the capital, Dhaka, despite the imposition of a nationwide curfew to try to quell anti-government unrest. In all, more than 100 people have been killed in the violence of the past few days, according to data from hospitals gathered by news agencies. The demonstrations were triggered by the reintroduction this month of an unpopular system of quotas to give some highly coveted civil service jobs to relatives of veterans. Students took to the streets to say the jobs should be awarded on merit, not because of family connections. Security forces used live rounds, rubber bullets and tear gas against protesters who defied the curfew and blocked roads. All this is happening as Bangladesh is largely cut off from the rest of the world. The authorities shut down mobile and internet networks in a bid, they said, to calm the protests. In Dhaka, many of the injured were taken to the city's biggest government hospital. Bappi Sheikh, a student, was collecting donations to help others who'd been wounded during the clashes with the security forces.
This illegal government is trying to exterminate the students. Wherever they find students, they shoot them like birds. That's what's happening now.
Outside the hospital, one woman, Shahida Begum, was mourning the death of her nephew. She said the 16-year-old was shot during clashes between protesters and paramilitary forces.
My nephew was an innocent kid. He was such an innocent young boy. Why did they kill him in such a cruel manner? I want justice.
Professor Ali Riaz is professor of politics at Illinois State University. Just how serious a challenge does he think this is for the Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's government after 15 years in power?
What we have witnessed, it clearly shows that there is a huge discontent and it is posing a challenge to the survival of the regime. Despite the fact that this movement started as the student movement for reforming the quota system, now it has escalated into a movement that is being participated by all walks of life. You know, and yes, it is posing a serious challenge which this government has not faced in the last decade.
Can you give me just a simple explanation about the problems with the quota system and why this issue is the issue that led to these more widespread protests?
One of the major part of the quota system is that it actually provides jobs, which gives it for the second and third generation descendants of those who participated in the war of liberation in 1971. The issue here is not they're against keeping those, but the numbers. Now that it is putting to the second, even third generation, there is widespread understanding that the system has been abused and this has benefited those who are close to the regime. So that is what actually is with respect to the reservation or the quota system. Altogether, 56% of the government jobs are reserved. When it started, it was a quota system issue. But it escalated into something different because of the existing discontent, political and economic, that has taken it out and beyond.
Can the Prime Minister bring about any change, though? Because she is also under pressure from the families of freedom fighters who benefit from that same quota system.
As a matter of fact, she can. The government executive decision can. Because the extent of the use of it, it doesn't have to be like this. Nobody is suggesting that this should be completely eliminated. But 50 plus years later, giving it to the third generation, that makes it somewhat controversial. And also, more importantly, how fairly it is being used. Meaning that there have been reports that it has been abused by people. So, yes, Prime Minister might be under the pressure of the generation, the descendants of the freedom fighters, but there is a valid reason for that. And interestingly enough, there have been commissions and committees who have looked into the quota system previously, which recommended that this needs to be reformed and revised.
Professor Ali Riaz speaking to Celia Hatton. The BBC asked to speak to government representatives, but no one was available. As services from airlines to healthcare, banking to broadcasting have mostly come back online after Friday's global IT outage, there are warnings it could take days, possibly weeks, for all tech systems to fully recover. And in the meantime, people should be on the alert for criminals who may try to exploit the situation. The massive worldwide disruption to Microsoft systems was caused by a botched software update issued by a cybersecurity company, CrowdStrike. Around 9,000 flights have been cancelled since Friday. It's not just travellers who still face disruption. Emergency services are trying to clear large backlogs, especially in busy cities like New York. Anthony Almahera, a paramedic, told the BBC the outages had set the city's emergency 911 system back by decades.
All of the 911 system is using this Microsoft Cloud CrowdStrike software. So I have no access to monitor units, to the dispatchers. The computers are shut down in dispatch, so they're dispatching through the old Cardex systems, which was in place in the 70s and 80s. The units that are out in the field, the ambulances, are usually tracked via GPS to ensure safety and other things, and they cannot be tracked at the moment. And New York City's EMS system, the ambulance system, does 5,000 to 6,000 calls a day. So as the day is worn on, the call volume is starting to spike, and it's getting harder and harder to keep up the pace.
Now services are returning to normal, regulators will be looking at how a small software update could have wreaked so much havoc. And with many people out of pocket to the tune of thousands of dollars, who might have to foot the bill for the huge global IT outage? William White is a technology lawyer.
It's notoriously hard to quantify losses in these kind of situations. And even if a business can quantify its losses, there's no particular reason that they would let the public know. But I would be unsurprised if the losses flowing from this are well into the billions. I mean, imagine if you're an airline that has planes sitting on the ground, not generating revenue. You've got to pay compensation to passengers. You might have to pay to fix the problem. You have to bring in a different flight crew. And so many businesses are impacted that the losses are going to add up very quickly. And of course, some of the impacts are also going to be non-financial. Like if you've been sitting on the ground in an airport, missed an important event, you've missed a hospital appointment, then you're never going to get that time back. And the great irony is that CrowdStrike provides cybersecurity software. And the thing that's caused this massive incident was an update to a piece of software that was designed to protect against cyber attacks. So I've seen a lot of people commenting that there will be huge legal action against CrowdStrike following this. I'm not so sure for a couple of reasons, and it all depends on what is in the contract between each customer and CrowdStrike. So if you wanted to say that CrowdStrike were liable for some of these losses, you'd need to show that they were in breach of that contract in some way. And you might think, it's obvious, look at what's happened. But bear in mind that what we're dealing with is essentially a mistake. It's just one that happens to have had catastrophic consequences. So it might not be so easy to prove that breach. And then even if you can, then it's really common for enterprise software contracts for products like CrowdStrike to be negotiated from the service provider's template. So you will probably find in a lot of these contracts that there are very far-reaching exclusions of liability. Say, for example, CrowdStrike might have said, we're not liable for loss of revenue, loss of profits, indirect losses. And a lot of the biggest losses we've been talking about are exactly those kind of things. And then, third hurdle, even if you can overcome that, there are also likely to be financial caps on their liabilities. So usually by reference to the fees that the customer has paid. You might think that that's unfair at first glance. But the usual argument that people make is that the risk to the software provider of entering into a contract should reflect the reward that they get out of it. There's a policy question. Do we think it's fair that CrowdStrike should go out of business because of what is essentially a mistake when the scale of the outage is because so many customers have been happy with their product to date?
Technology lawyer William White. Still to come, an emotional reunion for an American woman who spent 43 years in jail for a crime she didn't commit.
You were just a baby. Mom sent me a picture of you.
I got the little fingers.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. On the 50th anniversary of the Turkish invasion that resulted in the island of Cyprus being divided between a Turkish and a Greek side, Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said there's no point trying to reunify it or resuming peace talks with that goal. He made the comments as he marked the anniversary by attending a military parade in the Turkish-occupied north. Both the Cypriot president and the Greek prime minister back dialogue to try to reach a peace deal. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, reports.
A siren sounds at dawn in Cyprus, exactly half a century after the invasion which left the island divided. There had been years of violent conflict between the Greek and Turkish-speaking populations, with atrocities committed on both sides. Then, in 1974, Cyprus said it would join Greece, prompting Turkey to invade, to protect its people, Ankara said. There have been attempts to bring the two sides together ever since, and today saw the Cypriot president Nikos Christodoulides once again express this hope.
If we really want to send a message on this tragic anniversary and honour all those who sacrificed themselves in order for us to exist today, it's to do anything possible to reunite our homeland.
Peace proposals have involved creating a single Cyprus as a federal state, with enhanced autonomy for the Greek and Turkish-speaking sides. But that goal was rejected today by Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
We cannot get anywhere by ignoring the realities on the island. We believe that a federal solution in Cyprus is not possible.
There are still thousands of people missing from the Cyprus conflict, volunteers still digging up the soil to find those buried in unmarked graves. 50 years on, the bitter divisions which led to their deaths seem once again unlikely to be healed.
Paul Moss. An American woman who served 43 years for a murder she did not commit has been released after her conviction was overturned. Sandra Hemme is believed to have served the longest known wrongful conviction of a woman in US history. Sophie Smith reports.
You were just a baby. Mom sent me a picture of you.
And I'm a little bigger.
Sandra Hemme has just walked out of a correctional centre in Missouri, where some of her family she's not yet been able to meet is waiting for her. Now 64 years old, Sandra has spent the majority of her life behind bars for a crime she did not commit. When she was only in her 20s, Sandra was found guilty of stabbing to death a library worker called Patricia Jeschke in a town in Missouri State. She was given a life sentence. But a recent review of the case found that there was no evidence linking her to the crime, except for her confession, which was given under duress. The then young woman had been heavily sedated in a psychiatric hospital while investigators repeatedly questioned her. A judge ruled on June 14th that her lawyers had established what he called clear and convincing evidence of actual innocence. But Missouri's Republican Attorney General, Andrew Bailey, fought against her release in the courts. Sandra was not able to walk free until a month later, this Friday, when the judge ordered the prison to release her within hours, or he would hold the Attorney General in contempt. Her lawyer, Sean O'Brien, said he was thrilled at the decision.
It was too easy to convict an innocent person. It was just way too hard. It shouldn't be this hard to free an innocent person.
After 4 decades behind bars, it's not going to be easy for Sandra to pick her life back up. She won't be eligible for Social Security, and it may be difficult for her to find employment. But she has been reunited with her family.
I'd ever seen you and your mama. You look just like your mama when you were little, and you still look like her.
I get that a lot.
That report by Sophie Smith. Now, tourism is a key part of economies like Thailand's, but often the money goes to big international travel firms. Now, as Thailand tries to recover from the pandemic, it's looking at ways of helping local people benefit more from tourism. One scheme is trying to help local communities by organising people into small companies that can borrow money to create experiences for tourists. The social enterprise called Local Alike then runs tours to those areas. William Kramer has been to the village of Phong Thai, which managed to secure a loan of $100,000, to find out more.
So I'm just coming to this little area here where there's a couple of ladies with a loom. Long has always woven mats for herself, but now she's starting to teach visitors.
Long is going to show me how to make a keyring.
I've taught tourists to make them, and they're always happy to take their finished products home with them. They seem to really enjoy the experience.
Local Alike has been working here in Pontai for a year and a half. I take a walk through the village with Somsak Bunkam, whose nickname is Pai. He's the founder of the organisation. The silk factory is another local attraction for curious tourists.
I actually enjoy it when they come and look around. It gives me a chance to share my knowledge and it's rewarding.
62-year-old Tong Shui.
When tourists come to our village, they bring another source of income. This allows us to teach our traditions to our children, giving them the opportunity to work here and stay close to home instead of having to leave and find work elsewhere.
Pontai is located a 7-hour drive northeast of Bangkok. Pai has honed in on the region's unique cuisine to draw people in.
So some ladies have just brought in round circular trays and they're all full of dishes with beautiful looking salads. This is very, very Instagrammable.
Normally we have a chef, like a young generation chef in Bangkok, to come and teach and train them how to do the decoration.
This one is a chicken, grilled chicken, so they mix with the red ant.
With what? Red ants?
Red ant.
Okay, let's try it.
In the old days, people in this village ate this dish when they were feeling under the weather. It's said that the ants release a liquid which whets the appetite. To be honest, the ants don't really have a strong flavour, but they do make for a great traveller's tale, something to remember and maybe boast about in a hostel back in Bangkok. There is also another advantage to having a really strong structure in place. They've had a well for years, but the water from it wasn't clean. The villagers had to go to the next village to buy their water and then they had to bring it back. The bank was willing to give them that big loan and the village has used that money to dig 3 more wells and install a filtration system. I took a look at it with Pai and also with the woman who's responsible for running the new system, Moi.
Now we only pay 5 baht and it used to cost 13 baht.
The villagers don't just use the water themselves, they now sell it on to neighbouring villages. That money goes back into the village company. But it's not just the well. The fund has paid for community kitchens and a redesigned village square. So far, there's only been about 30 tourists to the village, but the community is already benefiting.
That report by William Kramer. The Olympics in Paris are less than a week away, and the French hosts are hoping to show off not just their sporting prowess, but also their savoir-faire in haute cuisine. In a country famed for its rich gastronomic history, French chefs will be offering pop-up restaurants and dining experiences to impress those who've come to watch the Games. Harry Bly reports.
Millions of visitors are expected to flock to Paris over the coming weeks to watch the Olympic Games. And there's plenty to enjoy. The swimming in the Seine, sailing, surfing, skateboarding, boxing, breakdancing, basketball, but also Bœuf Bourguignon and Blanquette de Veau, because it's France. So, of course, there'll be a focus on food.
I would call it it's a calm before the storm, you know. Because...
This is Grégory Marchand, chef and owner of the Michelin star Frenchy restaurants in Paris. He's one of 80 chefs who are setting up a pop-up restaurant serving a range of cuisines to those visiting the city for the games.
I will be cooking for guests, you know, doing a little show and, like, you know, talking to people. I think it's going to be a great party. I'm really eager to see the city, you know. We've been waiting for it for so long now.
His pop-up restaurant is in a very well-known location and will be serving spectators of the beach volleyball.
Yes, it's right under the Eiffel Tower. So, you know, I could think of a worse way to spend a beautiful day eating great food and watching beach volley.
With classic French dishes like moule frites being served, also on Chef Marchand's menu, a tomato tartlet served with strawberries and a basil sabayon.
I mean, we're in the heights of summer now. We have beautiful products available. We'll be using mostly vegetable from our farm that is 40 minutes outside of Paris, and something light and fresh.
Other pop-ups will appear in all of the key locations for the Olympics. There will be lobster ravioli at the Palace of Versailles, catering for the equestrian events. At the skateboarding near the Palais de Tokyo, pop-ups will serve gazpacho, bao and choquettes. And there are two open-air brasseries being constructed on bridges across the River Seine. Gregory Marchand is adamant you can't take the gastronomy out of the French experience.
This is a great way for us to welcome the people from all over the world and to showcase what the best France has to offer. Food and hospitality is part of it. And there's been a huge work to showcase that. And I think you know, it will make us all proud, and we're eager to make special moments for our guests.
To be clear, it's not all overly fancy food. Yes, there's a rhubarb consommé and smoked aubergine with haddock cream, with prices reaching €8,500. But smaller, more typical French delights, such as quiche Lorraine, crepes and galettes, will be readily available. And it's reported there'll be hot dogs too.
Bet you're feeling hungry now. That report by Harry Bly. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Alison Davies. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.